was the second good afternoon. Okay, now we have to start. Thank you very much for coming to what is the first of a two-parter on matters of poaching. Poaching jobs, poaching clients, poaching employees. And you'll see what that means as we play it out over the course of this week as well as next week. I am grateful once again to Zeifman's for hosting and providing this great lunch. There are two sign-in sheets. One I started on this side, one I started on that side. Please make sure to sign in. If you would like to be on our weekly email list, there's a box you can check in order to get on that list. If you do not want to, then just leave the box blank and that's fine. But I like to have people sign in so that I can follow up afterwards on questions that come up during the talk and the issues that I think of later, and I can send out the source sheets for week two. Please note that the things that I say are not to be taken as final decisions, verdicts, psoc. These are, we're learning about topics rather than deciding them. And one last note for anybody who might be interested. On Sunday morning, I'll be giving a class with CPD credit for lawyers, but it's open to non-lawyers as well. It'll be at the Bayit at 8:45 a.m. from 8:45 to 10. It's approved for 1.25 hours of professionalism credit. The topic is the blindness of the bribed, avoiding conflicts of interest. So that'll be Sunday morning at the Bayit at 8:45 a.m. Okay. Yes, buy it, bait, whatever you want to call it. We have larger fish to fry. So if you take a look on your sheet, you see four vignettes. And these are basic cases that I've been asked about. Really, it's three vignettes and then a fourth question. The first one. Lisa, a corporate accountant, learns that her new neighbor's company uses a different firm for their audits. Somebody moved in next door, they met, they schmoozed, she finds out the neighbor has a company. May she pursue that business for herself? In other words, try to convince the neighbor to drop their current affiliation and start working with Lisa's company. That's question number one. Question number two. What if Lisa's new neighbor's company is negotiating with that other firm but hasn't signed any agreement? So they're in conversations. Is it okay for Lisa to say, well, you know, they haven't decided anything yet, even if you'll tell me it's inappropriate for me to intrude on an existing arrangement? What about when they're just talking? Am I allowed to then step in? Third, David, a newly certified tax accountant, knows that his friend has an accountant he's been using for taxes on an annual basis since 2005. It's now 2014. May David pursue his friend's business for his 2015 filings? You know, it's been a year-by-year renewal of service. So technically speaking, there is no agreement yet regarding the 2015 filings. On the other hand, he's renewed every year for the last 9 years. So that's the question. Is that considered to be an existing arrangement such that one will be intruding? Or is it legitimate to say, nothing's been arranged yet for next year, and therefore I could pursue that business? And I tried to come up with accounting examples, but this obviously translates to all sorts of other businesses. It's not accounting specific. And then the last question. In all of the above cases, let's say it's inappropriate for me to interfere with somebody else's relationship. Let's say, going back to the first case, that it's inappropriate from a Jewish law, Jewish ethics standpoint for me to interfere and try to take away business from somebody else. On the other hand, let's say I did interfere. I approached the client and said, I'd like your business instead. So is there anything wrong with the client saying, you know what, they're offering me a better deal, or they're my neighbor and I'm going to see them every day? I'd like to switch. Is there anything wrong with that? So that's something we have to discuss as well. Now, the problem that I encountered as I started creating the vignettes is I realized that really the best way to do this is first to preface with three principles of Jewish law that relate to these sorts of cases, and then to apply them to all the cases, meaning this isn't the sort of thing where you can go through one of them, build one idea, second case, build a second idea. All three principles have applications in all of these cases. So what I'd like to do is spend our time today laying out three principles within Jewish law that deal with all of these cases. And then, after that, really, next time to apply them directly to the cases at hand. So I think that's the best way to pursue this. From a fundamental perspective, what we're dealing with in all of these issues is a matter of competing interests. And we'll see that very clearly in all the sources that we deal with. One interest, from a Jewish law and Jewish ethics standpoint, is the desire to protect existing businesses. And then on the other side is you want to allow competition. We believe that competition helps the community, right? As there are more competitors, there will be lower prices, there will be better service. So therefore, it's good for the community if you encourage competition. If you overweight on the side of protecting existing businesses, you harm the community, number one. Number two, you become like the city of Sodom, right? In the city of Sodom, they said, we don't want to help outsiders. Right, there's a classic story, which I already blew the punchline for by telling it this way, but that's okay. The story is told about the Vilna Gaon, although actually, I think it's actually about Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, that he had a seat on the town council, but he didn't go to the meetings. Right? We know people like that. He had a seat on the town council. He wouldn't go to the meetings. He said, I'll go to the meeting if you have something new that's come up and you want my opinion on it. So they had a problem with Mishulachim, with people coming to town to collect for causes from elsewhere. And they decided that we're going to come up with a new ordinance. Our rule is going to be that people who come from some other city can get a fixed amount that we're going to allot them, and that's it. They can't circulate. They can't ask people for help. That's it. We send them on their way. And they invite him in to hear this this case, to hear this ordinance that they're discussing. And he says, I told you, only invite me for something that's new. And they said, well, this is new. He said, no, it's not. Open up a chumash. It's right there. That's the city of Sodom. Right? We don't want to give to anybody else from the outside. We want to send them on their way. So, in any case, that's one problem, is if you protect your existing businesses too much, you harm the community and you harm the outsider, the person who wants to innovate and start something new. On the other hand, what's the risk if you overweight on the side of allowing competition? What's the risk on the other side? People will lose their business, right? You kill existing businesses, you reduce the incentive for people to even enter business, right? Because I can't know that I'm actually going to have the option of bribing. We've seen this type of competition, or competing interests, really, in other issues. When we talked about bankruptcy legislation, right? We talked about, on the one hand, wanting to encourage lending, and then on the other hand, we wanted to make sure that the borrower would have a way out, a way to deal in the event that he ran into trouble. We've seen this in any number of issues. So that's the fundamental problem that we deal with here. And so what we're going to see are three Talmudic paradigms for protecting one party from competition by others and the tension that's involved in all of them. If you take a look at your sheet, and I want to thank also Reem for making the copies for this. She's not here. Okay. Let her know I thanked her, please. But if you take a look at the first area is the one that I called in the Hebrew there, you see it, Ani HaMahapech B'Charara, literally means a pauper who is pursuing a cake. Charara is a type of cake that they used to bake directly on coals, and so it would get singed. But that's neither here nor there for our discussion. The point is that that's going to talk about taking something in which a needy person has expressed interest. And when I say taking, it doesn't mean literally necessarily it was out there in the open and I picked it up, but it could also refer to business, trying to buy something that somebody else has already expressed an interest in. So I showed up at the used car lot and there's somebody already negotiating for a car, or to give one of our cases, there's somebody who is pursuing a client and negotiating with them, and I swoop in and offer a better deal and take the client away. So, take a look, please, at source number one, passage out of the Talmud. Rav Gidl havan hapech b'hahi ara. There was a plot of land, and Rav Gidl, one of the sages, wanted to buy it. Azal Rabbi Abba Zavna. Along comes another sage, Rabbi Abba, and he buys it instead. Azal Rav Gidl kable l'Rabbi Zera. So Rav Gidl goes to Rabbi Zera, who's a greater authority, and complains to him. Azal Rabbi Zera, v'kibla l'Rabbi Yitzchak Nacha. So Rabbi Zera goes and he complains to Rabbi Yitzchak Nacha. It's going up the chain of authority here. Ash Hashkechei, Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha finds Rabbi Abba, who had swooped in and bought the land. And Amar Le, Ani Hamahabech Bacharara, Uba Acher Venatz Lahemen Umai. Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha turns to Rabbi Abba and he says, hey, what happens if there's a pauper pursuing a cake and somebody else comes in and takes it? My, what's the rule? Amar Le Nikra Rasha. He said, such a person is called wicked. And then he asks him, so what do you think you were doing? He says, I didn't know. I had no idea that he was pursuing it. I just knew there was a piece of land, there's a for sale sign, and that was good enough for me. I didn't know. And so he says to him, well, then what I want you to do is I want you to give it to him. And they go back and forth because Rav Gidl doesn't want to keep it. He wants to give it away, but the other one doesn't want to accept it as a gift. And so what ends up happening is that neither of them have it, and the land sits vacant. That's actually the way the story ends. And they call it the land of the sages, Arad Rabbanan, because neither one wouldn't accept it as a present, and the other one wasn't willing to sell it to him. He only would give it to him as a present. So the result was that neither had it, which is a classically Jewish solution for the problem. So the story here indicates to us that if you pursue something that somebody else is pursuing, that can earn the title of Russia, the title of wicked. Now, that's a really big deal.
That a pauper is pursuing, not that somebody specifically says a poor person.
Right, good. So we're going to come back to the fact, Yehuda notes, it says a pauper was pursuing it, not just a random person, but somebody who is needy. So maybe there's a component of staka involved in this. Good point, we'll have to see that. Correct.
Sounds like here when he has a cake, the cake was sitting there, he took the cake away, he's popping it.
Right. So here we're going to have to see whether this is in fact talking about a cake lying on the ground, or whether what we're talking about is extends as well to purchase scenarios, and we'll see the way it's been applied.
Does Dory. Does it matter if they knew each other? Because it sounds like, what does it matter? Meaning that if you know a buddy of yours wants to buy a house and you want to buy a house, shouldn't the best or the highest price win, as opposed to if you already knew that someone got there before you, then you should continue driving and be not the number?
Right. So from a standard Western ethics perspective, it seems like Dory is right. And you know, I looked at the ethical code for accountants, and really they weren't concerned about this sort of competition at all. It's almost not there. But having said that, number one, you have the possibility, as Yehuda mentioned, that this could be a staka situation, and therefore we're trying to protect the needy person. And number two, the answer may be that Jewish ethics, in fact, demands more, and says, no, we don't believe in this open capitalism in which anybody can do anything, and in fact, maybe there are protections. We'll see. That's where we want to go with this.
How great is the responsibility to know who else is bidding in the market?
Also a good question. Do I now have to be concerned? Do I have to be concerned? Anytime I'm now going to approach a potential client, do I have to ask him to sign a disclosure form, you know, something that says, no, I am not under negotiation with anybody else, and I'm not... That's horrific to imagine. That's going to kill business for real. Sorry? What do you mean? Everybody wants shlishi? Well, George actually is talking about something very serious, which is there are different kinds of market scenarios, right? There's an open market auction type of scenario in which anybody can walk in, and then there are negotiations which normally take place in private and are a one-on-one. We have to deal with that too.
Right, but in auctions, the problem is you're taking away from someone else by getting hired. It's exactly the same thing here. No difference at all.
Well, you see one big difference. Except there's one big difference, which is, and again, we have to see it, but we will get to this. The fact that in an auction scenario, everybody walks in knowing that there's going to be competition. And I think that's a principal element of that. But let's go a little further with this, please. So the first point is, I want to make sure that it's understood, calling somebody wicked is a really, really bad thing in Torah. It's not simple. It's not just like, well, you can call him a bad name. So much so that there's a Gemara, actually a passage in the Talmud, it's Bava Metzia Ayin Aleph, which talks about if somebody calls somebody else a wicked person, Yoredim Olachayev, he is allowed to take reprisals against him. And what those reprisals are is subject to discussion like everything else. But the point is, it's considered a real offense. So how is it that we call this person wicked? What's the basis? So one answer offered by some is simply that this person violated the principle of Ve'ahavta L'Re'acha Kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. The Kesef HaKadoshim, commentary 2, the Shulchan Aruch to the Code of Jewish Law, mentions that and other psukim. We are supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves. Don't do something to him that you wouldn't want somebody to do to you. And it's as simple as that. That's one approach. Others quote a verse from Yechezkel, Ezekiel. Take a look at source number 2 and what the Talmud does with this verse. Darash Rav Acha Rabbi Chanina. Rav Acha Rabbi Chanina taught the following. There is a verse in the book of Yechezkel, of Ezekiel, which describes the behavior of somebody who is righteous. And it begins by saying, this person, El Heharim Lo Achal, does not eat of the mountains. Now, literally, in context, it probably means he doesn't worship idols, because there were idolatrous offerings that were brought on mountaintops. And that's what I would have guessed this meant. But the Talmud says no. Shalo achav bizchut avotav. He doesn't eat from ancestral merit, meaning that our ancestors are called mountains in the Torah, and then based on the Talmud's commentary on the Torah, we find them identified as mountains, and especially in terms of their merit. So if someone eats of the mountains, it means he's relying on their merit instead of building up merit of his own. Ve'inav lo nasa el gilulei beit Yisrael. He does not raise his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel. Once again, literally, a statement about idolatry. But it says here, it's not about idolatry, but rather, shalo halach bekoma zikufa. He does not walk upright, meaning in an arrogant posture. He doesn't swagger. And then, ve'es eshes re'ehu lo timei. He does not contaminate another's wife. Shalo yered lo umnus chaveiro. He doesn't enter the craft of another person. He doesn't compete with another person. What's going on here, and what this is about in all three, is fundamentally the Talmud is bothered because this verse is supposed to be talking about a righteous person. And if I take it literally, it's saying, what defines righteousness? Well, he doesn't worship idols, and he doesn't get involved in adultery. You know, that's a fairly low bar, as we define righteousness. So what the Talmud is doing is it's saying it's not to be taken literally. Rather, there are other elements here, and the point for us is, the last of the clauses, it defines righteousness as not entering into somebody else's craft, competing with him in business. And this is quoted by the Chasam Sofer, by Moshe Sofer. There's a similar passage in source number 3, regarding a verse in Psalms, from Psalm 15. Psalm 15, you may have heard people read aloud often at a funeral. It describes a righteous person, and one of the clauses there is, Lo asalare ehu ra'a. The righteous person will not do bad things to another. Shalo yered lo umnus chaveiro. He does not enter the craft of another person. So that's another approach, is to say, the basis for the Talmud saying that you can't pursue this item that the other person is pursuing is this verse in Yechezkel, which we understand to refer to entering the trade that somebody else is in, entering the craft that somebody else is in. That's a second possibility. So one possibility is it's a biblical issue, like love your neighbor as yourself. Another possibility is that it's from this verse in Yechezkel and Ezekiel, or the verse in Psalms. And then the last possibility is simply that it's rabbinic. There's no biblical prohibition against competing in this way, against pursuing it. However, the rabbi said, don't do it. Now, you're going to call me wicked for violating the words of the rabbis? You betcha. Take a look at source number 4. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Code of Jewish Law, gives an example. Hamagbia yadoa chaveiro lahakoso. A person who raises his hand to strike somebody else doesn't end up hitting him, but he tries. Just raising his hand to strike somebody else, Pasula Edus, is disqualified to testify in court, which is something we associate with someone who is wicked. He can't testify. Rabbinically, there's no biblical prohibition against picking up your hand against somebody else. However, that is already sufficient to disqualify him from testifying and to give him the title of being wicked. And of course, this will have echoes of a story in the Torah. Which story?
Moshe and
Exactly. Thank you. When Moshe sees the two Jews fighting, and he says, "Vayomer la rasha," he said to the wicked one, "Lama sakereyecha? Why will you hit the other?" So, literally, I could render that as, "Why are you hitting?" But rabbinically, we look at it. I think even Rashi makes the comment there. He says, "See that he called him wicked when he was about to strike. That already makes somebody wicked just for being about to." But the point is that we have a clear pedigree for a statement that we don't enter into other people's business. They are pursuing it. We aren't supposed to pursue it. Whether that's biblical, whether that's from the verse in Yechezkel or in Tehillim, or whether it's rabbinic. However, this can't be taken as absolute. Right? That means there is now a firm in town called the Zeichman's Accounting Firm, and I am not allowed to open up a new accounting firm. What's my boundary? Like, how far does this go? How do you implement this? Well, first of all, we have, as we said, a philosophy of not stifling legitimate competition. Because we want competition. Competition is good. And that leads to a very significant debate on limiting this rule. If you take a look at source number 5, commentary of Rashi to that story about the pauper pursuing the cake. Rashi takes this, he says, it is talking about Machzer Acharel Lizkos Ba Min HaHefker Oshi It's Nenelo Balabayas. He says, we're talking about a pauper who sees the cake on the ground and wants to pick it up for himself. It's ownerless. I left the word Hefker there in the English. Hefker means that which has no owners. So he wants to just pick it up and take it. Or he's asking somebody to give it to him. But it's a free gift. That's either way, it's something that's free of charge. Tosfot disagrees. In source number 6, Rabbeinu Tam, grandson of Rashi, looks at it differently. I'm going to say it outside of the text, but I brought the text so that you could see it. He disagrees and says it's not so. And first he quotes another source that seems to contradict this source. It says that if I see something on the ground and I fall on it, I'm about to grab it, and then somebody else comes along and grabs it away, it belongs to the second guy. So Tosfos says, how could that be? You just told me that someone who would do what he just did is wicked. How are you telling me that he gets the cake? So Tosfos suggests a different point of view. He says, you know where we say this rule, that you can't compete with somebody else for the cake? It's talking about where the item is replaceable. If I don't get this item by interfering here, I can get it somewhere else. So I go to the store, and there's somebody in the store who I see trying to get something from a shelf. They want that item on the shelf. There's another one down the row. If I take this one that he was trying to take, I am in the wrong. Or, to apply it to our discussion about clients, if somebody's negotiating with a particular individual, says, I want to do your taxes. There are a million people who need their taxes done. So if I go and interfere with that negotiation, and this person is not special, he doesn't have some special business or whatever it is that's irreplaceable that I'm not going to find elsewhere, then I'm in the wrong for interfering. However, if it is something which is unique, it's unique because of the type of business, because of the scale of the business, then I'm within my rights to say, I want to be able to get this business here. And he says, the case of the charara, the case of the cake, is specifically not a case of an ownerless item. Because ownerless items sitting on the street are rare. Right? The idea that I'm just going to be able to find a nice cake somewhere is not usual. That's not something that normally happens. If it's something that is rare, I am entitled to compete for it. Because I'm not going to be able to get it somewhere else. That's the way that Tosfos takes it. And he says, and the logic is, this, the source that I quoted before, the Kesef HaKadoshim, says, the logic is simple. We have a rule within the Torah, we've discussed it on other occasions, called Chayecha Kodmin. If it's about your life or somebody else's life, your life comes first. If two people are wandering in the desert and there's only enough water for one of them and one guy is holding the water, he doesn't give the water to the other guy, he drinks in order that he should be able to live. As hard as that is to imagine implementing, that's the law on the books. So that here, I don't have to say, well, let him go get it. I'm entitled to get it. Unless it's something I could easily get elsewhere, in which case it's wrong for me to take it away from him. It's more appropriate for me to let him have it. Yeah.
There are exclusions on this, but actually the exclusions that are in civil law and all basically tell you, if you're working for a company and you want to go on yourself and compete with them, you have to have a 6 month to 1 year thing. It's exactly what's left. You need the time, you cannot compete with them during this time period, which gives them enough time to do whatever, can't borrow, your clients can't borrow anything. So it's basically the same idea.
Well, as the you mean the agreement after he leaves the firm?
After he leaves, right. You cannot compete with them for a 6 month to a year period.
I hear that. Yeah.
Basically the same thing.
Yehuda. That's good. The way you're describing this from Tosfos, it just seems interesting that he would use this Harara as his like sort of quintessential example of something that's like hard to replace, when you described it before as like a poor man's cake, which I think I would interpret to mean something cheap, easily replaceable, you know, easy to find, easy to make. I mean, what definition of the fact that why it's a poor man's cake?
Right. Right, the truth of the matter is that Tosfos' principle is hard to fit into this, for the point that you mentioned, that a Harara does not sound like some expensive item, number one. And number two, well, no, I'm sorry, that part of it does work. Because the point is that the case here where he's called wicked is a case where he could have gotten it elsewhere. So the Harara is the poor man's cake, you could have gotten it elsewhere. My problem with this, in terms of the language, is that the language, as you noted before, doesn't really sound like purchase language, it sounds like gift language. And he's defining gift as a case that doesn't fit under this law, as a case of something that's more rare. So that's my problem. The Harara doesn't bother me. It's the Mahapech that bothers me, so to speak. And not to know that he came and he took it. It really doesn't sound like a purchase discussion.
Well, so especially Harara is a free food, and that's like most people's favorite food, right? Free food, so.
Yeah. Witness the lunch. We're here, right? But I want to clarify this a little bit further, because we have to discuss, once Tosfos says that if this is a special opportunity, I am allowed to compete, how special does the opportunity have to be in order for me to be allowed to compete? Let's give the following case. I'm going to go back to the store discussion for a second, although you can easily apply it to clients as well. It's Black Friday, and I can go to this store and I can purchase an item at a 10% discount. I run into the store and I see somebody else has it and it's the last one on the shelf, right? I want to grab it away and say, but this is a unique opportunity. How unique is it if it's 10% off? Well, to a certain extent, that may depend on what the price is, right? 10% off of a $10 item is different from 10% off from a $1,000 item. So maybe percentages aren't the best way to argue it. But that's a question. One question is, you know, what kind of difference in sale price is sufficient? Another question is, how great an opportunity does this have to be? If you take a look, actually, let me show you. If you take a look at source number 7, Rabbi Moshe Isserles contended the following. V'chein im kone davar echad u'bachadero v'yuchal l'knoso bizol. If I buy something and somebody else comes along and he is able to buy it, if I buy something, or I'm in the process really of buying something, and someone else comes along and yuchal l'knoso bizol she'eino motzei l'knoso kach b'makom acher, this purchase is available at a low price. He couldn't necessarily get it that way elsewhere. Havi kamo mitzia, Rabbi Isserles says, it's just like a found object, and a discount matters. Have being able to get it at a discount. He doesn't say how much of a discount it has to be. He just says a discount qualifies as making it unique. And by the way, this takes me back to the question of why they mentioned the pauper specifically in here. One piece of this that I neglected to mention, I'll say it now, is let's say you have an item that's available here that's rare. Right? The item that's available here is rare. It's not that it's expensive, but it's hard to find. And now it's available over here, and I need it. Let's say I am in need of, I'm trying to come up with a client case in particular, but let me leave it with the store just because it's the easiest thing. I'm in need of a lawnmower. Okay, spring is beginning. I need to get a lawnmower. There's one lawnmower left there, and all the stores are out of lawnmowers, right? It's wintertime, and they're all out of salt, and the salt is available here, nowhere else. It's relatively cheap, but they're the only ones that have it, and there's a last bag there. Am I allowed to grab it away and say, this opportunity is rare? So the argument goes that we look at that word, ani, a pauper, in this case, and we say, a pauper is really a relative term. Pauper doesn't mean somebody who is earning less than the poverty line. It means somebody who has a particular need. And therefore, if I need this item right now, I am a pauper. offer vis-a-vis that item. And it doesn't matter that it's a cheap item. If I can't get this elsewhere, and I need the salt, or I need the lawnmower, then I am a needy person, and therefore I am able to make that that claim. It fits into Tosfos' argument. So we could be looking at this and saying, well, is this item cheaper than elsewhere, or is this item available here and not available elsewhere? Either one may end up being a justification. Dori, and then Gersh.
Just to disagree with you, but then they would have used the example of a donkey, or just a different thing. I think Tosfos substance, which I would refer that the need here is to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So if a person is not in a hunger situation and able to get food somewhere else, then it would be a worthy thing to do to take it away from someone who does have a need for it.
Or you could argue the other way around, that by saying that, you've limited the application only to food items, and it won't apply to other items at all. I'm not sure, once you start reading into that, you run the risk of opening it in either direction. Gershon.
Using your example, by the little moral of the package of salt, if you have a physically able person, someone who's not so physically able, pursuing that item, and the physically able person is getting it first, would this not come under the case of poverty? Because he's the one who's disabled, disadvantaged, which means the able one is supposed to make the disabled one aware. Okay, oh, you want it, oh, you can have it.
Well, again, unless he's going to argue, but I can't get this. He can argue, I can't get this elsewhere. In which case, they're both in the pauper position.
You take something, is it need or want? A child says, I need, meaning I want. But you say he needs the item, he wants the item,
right.
And you're hopping away.
Right. And it's an interesting point. I'm not sure how to resolve that exactly. I agree with you. And it actually comes up in the next case that I want to show you. Source number 8. Another area in which this comes up, outside of stores and outside of clients, is the shidduch scene. The question then is, are you allowed to step in? There's a young man, young woman, or not young, it doesn't matter, who are dating. And somebody else, another guy, comes along and he says, I would like to be able to step in. I would like to approach her. So the question came from Moshe Feinstein. The question of, are you allowed to try to interfere? And the argument is, this fellow's argument is, she is special. You're telling me there are lots of fish in the sea, but she's special. And this is the one I want. Want/need. So the question is he within his rights to say this is a unique opportunity? So take a look at what Rabbi Feinstein wrote in source number 8. The Shulchan Aruch brings both views of Rashi and of Tosfot about the license to step in where something is a special opportunity, and the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, Rabbi Isserles, follows the view of Tosfot. If it's a special opportunity, you are allowed to. But Rabbi Feinstein writes the following: Umeachar shaharamah masik shesvara harishona ikar. Since the Ramah, Rabbi Isserles, concludes that in fact the first view is correct. The view that states, there was the first view in the Shulchan Aruch, the view that states that you're allowed to step in if it's a unique opportunity, then there's no prohibition for the guy who specifically wants to marry this girl for him to step in. Right? It's a good thing for all those romantic comedies out there that rely on this as a plot device.
Right.
The Aval. Min haroi liray Hashem lahachmir lochush lisvara achrona shishitas Rashi. He says, on the other hand, the other view is Rashi's view. Says you're not allowed to step in. If you're a God-fearing person, then you won't do it. This is a test. If you're a God-fearing person, then you won't do it, and you'll just say, look, it'll work out the way it's supposed to work out. That's his position. Now, one last point on this topic before we move to the second category. We said that if I see somebody else pursuing something, and I intervene, and I intervene inappropriately, it's a case where I could have just as easily gotten it somewhere else, then that labels me a Rasha. Is there any other penalty? I'm not happy about being called a Rasha, but maybe I say, it's worth it. In this case, it's worth it. So take a look at source number 9. Rabbi Shlomo Luria, great authority in Jewish law, lived in, as you see there, 16th century Poland, and he wrote a responsum which dealt with many of these issues, and sort of, if you're dealing with this topic, you have to read this responsum. He did a lot of work that everybody else built on. So he writes, Ulefi ra'os einei habezdin yeirah elahachmir. He says, based on the view of the rabbinical court in the particular case at hand, they may decide to be strict. Kasher pasak harambam, as the Rambam ruled, meaning that the Rambam ruled that indeed rabbinical courts are allowed to make special fines and enactments in cases like this. Lefi sheyesh kach biyad based in lahachmir, lefi anira beineyam yosim yidin ha-gemara. Because rabbinical courts are indeed empowered to do that. So in other words, the rabbinical court is within its rights to actually take the item away. In the event that you grabbed the client away, they're within their rights to say, we are removing you from dealing with this client. If they feel it was egregious enough, or they feel that it's widespread as a practice, and therefore they need to make a statement, they're actually empowered to call a halt to it. That's all the first category. I saw him pursuing it, and I went for it. But I want to shift now to the second category. The second is the briefest of the three. And it's the case called Ani Hamanakev Berosh Hazayis. And it literally it means a pauper who is striking at the top of a tree. And top of an olive tree. And what that means is, and if you've ever seen an olive harvest, but the way they harvest olives is that they actually hit the tree with sticks, and the olives come raining down, and you get them. So you have a case in which a pauper climbed up to the top of the tree. He is hitting the tree. Along comes somebody else. He says, thank you very much. And he gathers up all the olives, and he goes home. I can't believe you're laughing. That's not funny. So the question now is, what sort of liability is there? It adds to the previous case. In what way? Why is it not the same as the Ani Amahapech Bacharara?
Because the tree belongs to either the owner or to someone.
Great. So actually, I should specify the tree is hefker. The tree is ownerless in this case. The classic case is that this was either peya or shechacha. It's one of the gleanings that's left for people.
You may have an obligation to pay for a service that's rendered or recognize the fact that someone else had, you know, assisted you in using
this. The point is, he hits a tree, he gets automatically acquiring the fruit that's falling off.
Okay, so let's play this out. First of all, in terms of saying he has a kinyan, so he doesn't. Meaning, striking the tree, it's a good thought, but it doesn't give him so much that they discuss. They distinguish between two different cases. In one case, he just hits it and the olives rain down. In the other case, he hits it, it falls into his hand, and he drops it down. In the latter case, he is said to have a kinyan, then he has acquired it, and it's out-and-out theft for anybody to take it. But in the case where he just hits the branch and it falls down, he hasn't acquired it. However, he has invested work, right, in a very visible way. That's number one, and even more than that, as we'll see in a moment. And number two, maybe I should have to reimburse him, because he did something that otherwise I would have had to do, or I would have had to hire somebody to do. So let's take a look and see how this is dealt with. Source number 10, but that's how it's different from the previous case. Now there's a clear investment of work on the part of the needy person. Source number 10 is a Mishnah in the volume called Gittin. It's within the context of a series of comments that deal with what we call Darkei Shalom, ways of peace and trying to promote peace. Ani Amanake Barosha Zayas, if a pauper is striking atop an olive tree, Masha Tachtov Gezel, taking that which is beneath him is theft, Mipnei Darkei Shalom, because of ways of peace. Meaning, it's not technically theft. Technically it's not, he didn't own it. But it's a violation of basic social contract, the way that we get along as a society, and you would create such problems if you start engaging in this way. That's one approach. And then Rabbi Yossi Omer Gezel Gomor. Rabbi Yossi says, what are you talking about? This is full-blown theft. This is not just a rabbinic thing. So the key here is indeed the issue of the strain that was involved for the pauper, and Maharshal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, in source number 11, explains this further. He says, first of all, he says, this isn't the same as the previous case, because here you exerted, as we just noted. However, he says also, you have to distinguish between types of exertion. Right? What constitutes exertion? Let's go back to the client discussion, right? I'm a real estate agent. I went door to door to every house on the block and said, are you interested in selling? Are you interested in selling? Are you interested in selling? Right? That's exertion. Does that mean now nobody else is allowed to go to them and pursue them as a client? Sorry? Right. What if, in addition to doing that, I took everybody on the block to dinner? right? And I said, I'd like to talk to you about the prospects for selling your house, and we had a discussion and so on. You know, or I sat down with someone in a house, and I actually did a study for them on what their house would be worth, and I did a study of what their house is worth, and I showed it to them, and I gave them information. There was a real conversation. At what point do we say, this is strange, such that he becomes Ani Hamanake Brosh Azayas, somebody who is like striking the tree? So take a look at source number 11, where Rabbi Luria writes, we have to distinguish between one type of strain and another. Because there are two different types. There is a type of strain that's entirely ineffective, meaning in terms of the law. On the other hand, there's another one, another type of strain, which actually renders this rabbinically prohibited theft. Lo nikra tarach, elaecha de tarach bigufo. So he says, first of all, it has to involve physical effort in order to be like the olive tree, as opposed to the case where I called somebody on the phone, or I talked to somebody who I met and said, I'd like to do business with you. He says, no, it has to be physical for it to be like the olive tree. Shut davar hanikar, and the reason is because it's a visible thing. Kigon ani menaket brosh hazayis, like the fellow at the top of the tree. She'ein tircha gedola mizeh lenyin zesim. She'nasa nasholamus. He says he's endangering his life going up that tree. And the Talmud has a discussion about whether he's even allowed to climb a tree, endangering himself just to make a living. The answer is yes, if that's normal for people to do. But the point is that it shows, we consider him to have done something great. That's the standard. It's not, you can't tell me that all competition is ruled out the moment someone has a conversation with somebody else about working for him or buying his product. It has to be a major physical effort. That's the position that Marshall takes. And this is clearly a matter of, on the one hand, wanting to protect the needy, and on the other hand, wanting to protect business. Right? And what you end up with that's very interesting out of this to me, is you don't have an enforceable penalty for it. Maimonides writes, when he discusses this, there is no penalty that a rabbinic court can give for such a circumstance. It's unfortunate. What he did was wrong. However, there's no penalty. Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein in source number 12 wrote, "Vim nitalan acher, someone else comes along and takes the olives. Ein ben bishum gezel gamur lahutzio bedayanim." He says that it is not full-blown theft, such that you could take it away by judges. But you should know he has sinned and God's going to zap him. That's not such a great position to be in. But he says rabbinical courts will not be empowered to deal with this. And I think fundamentally you're dealing with the problem of how you determine the strain and how far you're really going to go in this scenario. But that's the second of the three categories. There's a separate discussion to be had about benefiting from the other person's labor, and that's going to come into play next week when we actually apply these to cases. So don't forget the question of what you have to do with the fact that you benefited from his work. Okay. Third and last of our categories is called Yored Leumnuso Shel Chaveiro, getting into somebody else's business. And you see, source number 13 is a long source. It's several cases. It's really a set of cases which I divided into three parts for you, and I'm going to say it outside, but you can see it in the Gemara as we go along. The first type of case that you see is the case of creating competition by opening up a business next to somebody else to get the customers away from him. So, sorry. Okay.
That's core about it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's core about the pizza places.
So, in the first part of this, the first bullet point, Rav Huna says, if somebody sets up a mill on a street, and somebody else from the same street wants to come along and set up a mill next to him, Rav Huna says he's not allowed to do so. Now, I added in there a note, which is based on some of the commentaries to this, that it's talking about where the new one is going to set up his mill, closer to the entrance to the alley, and it's a closed alley. So what that means is all the people who came to me before are now going to go partway in. Oh, here's a mill. I don't have to lug my grain any further. And they're going to use him. So you're really robbing him entirely of his livelihood. That's one case. The second case involves a fisherman. where a person has set up his nets next to where he believes that the fish live, and we say that somebody else who wants to come along and set up his nets has to distance himself from the first fisherman. And can't set up opposite him. So the first set of cases is the issue of competing in such a way that you are going to take away his customers. Now, why isn't this the same thing as Ani Amahapech Pacharara? Why isn't this the same as our first case where someone is pursuing something? What have we added here? So I'll tell you in the interest of time. It's his livelihood now. It's not simply a cake you can get somewhere, an item you can pursue on the shelf, or one client. What we're talking about here is his entire living. If you are successful in setting up your mill there, if you are successful in setting up your nets there, he is completely out of luck. So he's lost his livelihood. That's the distinction that Rabbi Shlomo Luria, the Marechal, makes in this case. But that's the first. Yeah.
But doesn't that make a statement that there's a finite market? Can't expand or contract?
Well,
it argues a food court.
It's not necessarily, because what we're talking about is where I am at the entrance to the, by setting up at the entrance to the alley, it doesn't matter how large the market is, no one's coming from the other side. I'm always going to get their business. Right? It is assuming that I have the capacity to absorb all of that business. That's a separate point. But, you know, ditto in the fisherman case, we're talking about setting up right by this layer of the fish. So it is a finite market that we're dealing with. So, but that's the first set of cases. Then the second set of cases is talking about peddlers who circulate. And the rule that's stated is that Ezra, when he brought the Jews back for the second temple, made a rule in the land of Israel that you have to allow peddlers to circulate in the cities because it will benefit the population. People can buy the things that they want to buy. So no one can protest when outsiders come in to circulate. However, we're not going to allow them to set up a store on site competing with those who live here. Unless it's a Torah scholar, in which case we're going to allow him to do it because we value the fact that he's engaged in his Torah studies. We're going to come back to that case. We're not leaving that one alone. But that's the second set of cases. The first case is you set up beside somebody else. The second case is you come in from out of town and are going to compete locally. And then the third set of cases is the story of the wool merchants who came from elsewhere. And if you can see it, you can see it here. In the interest of time, I'm just going to say it in the English. Foreign wool merchants brought wool to a place called Pumnara. Pumnara literally is the mouth of the river. So they came in by ship. Local people tried to prevent them. They, the merchants, the new wool merchants, came to Rav Kahana. He said, you know, they can stop you. You can't set up shop, just like the peddlers that we talked about. You can't set up a place. They said to him, but we have debts. We have to pay our debts. What are we going to do? We invested in this. So he said, sell as much as you need to survive until you end your debts and then get out of town. He said, I'll let you, you know, make as much as you need to make just to survive, fine. And then you get a case of people who made baskets and they brought their baskets to Babylon. And again, the population tried to stop them. They came to Ravina and he said, so you know what, they came from outside, let them sell to the people from outside. They can't sell in the local market. They could sell to people who come in specifically on market day. Why market day? Because on market day it's understood that you're competing with everybody. Everybody brings in their wares on market day. So market day is unique. What emerges in all of this is, and by the way, they don't need to card the consumers to see whether they're from outside or not from outside. That's actually a discussion between various sources. But the point out of all of this is that the Talmud identifies here a prohibition against competing with somebody else in such a way that you take away their livelihood. As opposed to the previous cases, which dealt with a particular item, now we're talking livelihood. What's the nature of this prohibition? So it's subject to debate. Well, you'll see. You'll see. What's the nature of this prohibition? One view is that this is just not nice. It's just not nice. If you take a look at source number 14, Rambam, Maimonides, in a non-legal discussion, he's not discussing a matter of legal obligations, is describing how a Talmud Chacham, how a Torah scholar is supposed to behave. And it says he should be honest, he should deal in good faith, and he lists a whole bunch of things, a whole paragraph. And one of the things he says is that he doesn't enter to somebody else's craft. So Maimonides sounds like he's just saying it as, this is ideal behavior. it's not nice for you to take away somebody's business. And that's all it is, as it seems to be framed there. And that's an argument made by Rabbi Yitzhak Breizel in a volume of a journal called Eben HaMishpat. That's one view, and it sort of fits with the sources that we saw back in the beginning that quoted the verse from Ezekiel and the verse from Psalms. To be a good person means you don't compete with people in a way that takes away their livelihood. The Stechemet has it, but that's one view. There are other views. If you take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Yosef Karo, author of the Sephardic part of the Shulchan Aruch, wrote in his work, Beit Yosef, was troubled. He said, I don't understand. If it's prohibited to compete with somebody in such a way that you're going to take away their livelihood, how is it that in the Talmud we mentioned this exception for Torah scholars? Either it's prohibited or it's permitted. What are you doing?
They don't get paid.
They get paid and they do business there. So his answer in source number 15, Rabbi Caro's response, is to say, maybe the law saying you can't compete with others is a rabbinic prohibition. And they chose how to create it. They created it for certain circumstances and not for others. It depends on what the values are that are involved. However, there is another take which suggests that no, it's actually a concrete prohibition. There's a concrete prohibition, and there are a few ways we can look at it. One approach is to say that the reason why this is a concrete prohibition is because of what we call sheves. In the event that I attack somebody, if I were to attack somebody, I would have to pay him for the damage that I caused. I'm talking about a physical attack. So one of the types of damage that I may cause is he may not be able to work for a week. I have to pay him for lost wages. Well, take a look at source number 16, where Rabbi Karo ruled in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, if you lock somebody in a room so that he can't get to work, you have to pay him for the time he lost from work. Well, if I set up my shop right next to his and I steal his customers, he has lost the ability to work. That's the argument that Rabbi Breizel gives. What's the weakness in that argument? I didn't keep him from working. He can work all he likes. Nonetheless, that's one argument. I think the stronger argument, there's more to say about that, but in the interest of time, I'm skipping that. I think there's a stronger statement in source number 18. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, and earlier before him, the Masas Binyamin, said the same. He says, no, this is full-blown theft. He says, the entire category here is a biblical prohibition. It is full-blown biblical theft. Why? Because there's a verse in Devarim, in Deuteronomy, in which Moshe tells the Jews how he instructed their judges, and the judges are responsible to judge between parties, and this is part of judging between parties, making sure that people are able to live together. And so what he suggests is, the rabbis defined this as prohibited, and it becomes a biblical prohibition because this is what judges are supposed to do. In the same way that when it comes to the laws of Shabbat, there are certain areas of law which the Torah empowers the rabbis to define and to say, this is part of the definition of X, and it's a longer discussion. We don't have time to explain that fully here. But Rabbi Sofer says, the Torah empowers the rabbis to determine X is considered theft. And therefore, when the rabbis say this is considered a form of theft, it is actually full-blown theft. And therefore, it is biblical, and therefore you can go to take somebody to court for doing this.
Then you would be reimbursed if you were successful.
Yes, correct. That's the way that he frames it. So I'm actually going to pause here because I see that we're hitting the end of our time. We have a little more to say about this next time. But to sum up in just a couple of seconds, we've seen three different ways in which competition may be prohibited. Number one, somebody is pursuing something and it's an opportunity that I could just as easily get elsewhere. I am not supposed to enter into competition with him. And it would earn a person the title of being wicked, and potentially the court can sanction him. Second case, he has put in effort to get it. And in that case, we say, if it's significant effort, I'm not allowed to do it, and God is the agent of punishment in such a case, there may be a discussion about profiting from the work that he put in. And then the third case is taking away somebody's livelihood by my competition with him. We have set that up a little bit. We talked about whether it's a biblical prohibition or something else, and we still have to discuss some of the limitations on this and how it is applied, and then we'll turn to our vignettes and talk about how this applies when we talk about poaching clients away from somebody else, stealing a worker away from a business, and so on, God willing, next week. Once again, I thank Zeifman's for presenting us with lunch and for hosting this year.